The Latino Media Collective delivers consequential coverage from the biggest countries in South America to the smallest enclaves of Central America and the Caribbean, and is available on SoundCloud, iTunes Podcast, and Google Play Music. The Latino Media Collective is recorded in WPFW Studios and airs Fridays at 1 p.m. on WPFW Washington.
Welcome to On the Margin with E. Ethelbert Miller. My guest today is Alexis Pauline Gums. Alexis Pauline Gums is the author of Survival is a Promise, The Eternal Life of Audre Lorde. How are you doing this morning, Alexis?
I'm doing great. I'm so happy to be with you.
Well, you have given us a wonderful biography of Audre Lorde, so there's much for us to discuss this hour. But let's begin by discussing your doctoral thesis. While at Duke University, you examined the literary practices of Black queer feminist thinkers, Audre Lorde, Alexis DeVoe, Barbara Smith, and June Jordan. What connects these writers? How are they different? And are there other Black women writers and thinkers that you could have looked at?
Oh my goodness, I love that question. Also, I'm just a little bit floored, shocked, but honored that you even have engaged my dissertation. I just want to take a moment to thank you for who you are in our literary tradition, the way that you have been in conversation with, but also been lifting up our writers and thinkers for so many years. And it's really an honor to be in conversation
with you.
my dissertation, it's called We Can Learn to Mother Ourselves, The Queer Survival of Black Feminism. And I did really highlight those four writers, Audre Lorde, June Jordan, Alexis DeVoe, and Barbara Smith. But there were many, many more writers who, of course, I mentioned in the dissertation and who I did research on that was important to me. The reason that those four writers, though, really spoke to me in a particular way was because I was interested in how they each had a sense of how they were relating to poetics, the writing itself, how they were relating to publishing, how they were relating to the pedagogical responsibility of kind of like teaching what literature is, and they all were activists, right? So they were engaging these key terms that I was looking at, which are mothering and survival, in these four ways. And yeah, all four of them are different, you know, which is part of what was really exciting for me to look at. But then of course they're intertwined, you know. Of course, Alexis DeVoe wrote the first biography of Audre Lorde, and Audre Lorde and Barbara Smith collaborated to found Kitchen Table Press. And Audre Lorde and June Jordan were colleagues at CUNY and actively supported the student movements for open admissions there, and collaborated in multiple ways. And so, but for me, the through line was that they were thinking intergenerationally. Mm-hmm. They were all thinking intergenerationally in a transformative way. Mm-hmm. And so the decisions that we can see them making have to do with another future being possible.
Mm-hmm. But you know, and the other thing that you have there, you're calling them thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that's very important. You know, it's like we think of W.B. Du Bois, you know what I'm saying? But these women are thinkers, and they should be, you know, given credit for their minds.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And there's so much theoretical work that they were doing in every arena. I mean, in their poetry, in their letters, in their essays, in their teaching, and in their conversations. You know, one of the key places that I loved looking at the discourse around survival and also around mothering were the newsletters. You know, Cheryl Clark would often compile these newsletters at the end of the Black feminist retreats that the Combahee River Collective organized, and you would see, okay, what did we talk about? Okay, they were debating about our survival. They were talking about mother-daughter issues. They were talking about their own issues as parents. And these are really key conversations that we're still in today, but I think that we actually have more access to the guidance, the complexity of those terms when we turn to these thinkers.
You know, one other name I would mention, because I always felt that her mind was just fascinating, that was Sylvia Winter.
Oh,
You know,
yes.
you know, who's that? A whole nother dictionary and encyclopedia. Okay.
Encyclopedic is correct. Yeah.
But
And you know, my book Dub, which I published in 2020, it goes to Sylvia Winter's essays as just portal openers. You know, every single prose poem in that book is inspired by just like sometimes just one word, you know, like a moment of emphasis in Sylvia Winter's expansive body of work.
Well, you know, in your book, Survival is a Promise, you acknowledge Valerie Boyd and mention how she helped you write an ancestrally accountable biography. Your book is defined as a cosmic biography of Audre Lorde. And I want to know, what do you mean by that? And I looked at how Boyd had a spiritual connection with Hurston. It seems you have that with Audre Lorde. Is the writing of Lorde's biography a journey for you or a deeply spiritual awakening?
It's both of those things. And yes, Valerie Boyd has had such an impact on me. I had the gift of actually being at the first talk that she gave about Wrapped in Rainbows, her biography of Zora Neale Hurston. And she came and gave it at Barnard College, which was Zora Neale Hurston's alma mater, also my alma mater. And she told me this story much later that she had written this talk, but the printer wouldn't work. And she was not able to give the talk that she wanted to give, which, you know, she said it was objective, it was very, you know, measured. So she ended up having to speak from her heart. And what she spoke about was her spiritual connection with Zora Neale Hurston and how that guided her and how she felt that she was in deep relationship with Zora Neale Hurston throughout the process and beyond the process. And I
I
remember.
always used to tease her because she said, this is down, we're down in Florida, you know, at the Hurston Festival. She Hemingway is
Yeah.
speaking, and she says, then he was speaking, and he said, a black woman needs to write Hurston's story. And she, you know, and she said, and I said, but I was behind you, Valerie. I didn't see any glow or anything like that. I used to tease about that. But
Well,
you
she
know,
felt it
she felt
clearly.
it. But I want to make something and connect it to you. One of the things that I felt was very interesting in terms of this relationship between scholars. Hemingway opened up his files and everything to her. And I feel that it would seem as if Alexis DeVoe did the same thing to you.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think that's so important. Again, on this intergenerational scale, right? Alexis DeVoe had been talking for years about when is there going to be another biography of Audre Lorde? You know, that this is an important figure. We have so many biographies of every American president, right? But there are historical figures. We need multiple perspectives. And also because in each generation, we actually need the insight of these figures in different ways. And very practically, more things are available, you know, more digitized records of Audre Lorde's ancestors in Barbados and Grenada. There's more things that we can work with. And Alexis DeVoe was profoundly, she was the first person who I called about this possibility of writing this biography. And she was like, yes. And I think that, I mean, hopefully I'll get to feel this way in the future. You know, I think that there's something about understanding that the work that we do with these figures to bring their legacy forward into the future will be taken on by other people in the future. And that everything that we can do to support that process, I mean, Alexis definitely gave feedback on specific chapter drafts. You know, she was so available to me to ask questions about, you know, what do you remember about this? And all, I mean, there was so much generosity there, on top of the fact that, of course, her work on Audre Lorde was foundational for me even before I met her. And reading Warrior Poet, which was a gift that my sister Kyla gave to me one Christmas, because she was like, I know you love Audre Lorde. It has been such a foundation for me. So I'm very grateful.
Talk about Audre Lorde's relationship to the earth and your own relationship to the earth and the things you're doing in North Carolina.
Yes, I mean, this is one of the things that was most important to me and really the guiding force of this biography is that Audre Lorde was profoundly related to Earth. She understood herself in what I would call geological terms, and she understood the Earth as something that is in transformation, and we're part of that transformation. And we're part of Earth. You know, we don't just happen to be here. Like, we are actually part of this planet and how it exists and how it is
Now, of course,
evolving.
you're differing here from Sun Ra, who think that we should be from Jupiter.
Yeah, Sun Ra is like, let's leave. But I think I agree with Audre Lorde that there is actually, we're not just here. We are a part of this place. And of course, similar to Sun Ra, I think that we can have a transformatively different idea of what this planet is, even if we reject the idea of the world that that we could say Western culture has dominated, a colonial idea of the world as just a something to extract resources from, right? So we actually are on another planet if we follow Audre Lorde. It's just Earth, where we always have been and always must be. And so, I mean, here in North Carolina, I'm grounded here, right? And I was a person who moved around a lot as a young person. I didn't necessarily know that there would be a place that I would stay. I thought maybe I would live a whole bunch of places or live no place or have a nomadic life. But this place, I mean, North Carolina, my dear sister, womanist cartographer Michelle Lanier talks about Afro-Carolina. And when we think about the Black and Indigenous histories and energies, and especially creative life force that comes through this place, for me, it's something I can feel. You know, it's something I can feel if I go out and touch a tree. It's like there's so much here. And the stewards, you know, the Okanichi Band of the Saponi Nation, specifically where I live, they are still here and still in conversation with this river that gives us life force. And so I think that understanding ourselves as separate from Earth, it's a setup. You know, it's a setup and it has nothing to do with any of our indigeneity, our African indigeneity, our indigeneity, you know, on this land. That separation is designed to make us not know how powerful we are and to be endlessly exploitable. And Audre Lorde was clear about that. And part of her reparative work was her poetics were an earth poetics and her practice. You know, she was collecting stones and polishing them in the kitchen. And people would go to her house and she would be like, look at this crystal, and this is how a volcano formed it. You know, that was some people would say that was a part of her ministry, right? But it was also a part of the way that she grounded herself and allowed us to reclaim the fact that we are not tangential to this earth. We are absolutely a part of everything, everything from the temperature of the ocean to the lichen growing on a particular tree. We're part of all of it.
Well, you know, in a recent Sunday New York Times magazine, Jenna Wortham, who did an excellent article on you, wrote it. It's entitled "The Afterlives of Audre Lorde." In it, she quotes you using the term "Black feminist photosynthesis." Explain that concept.
Yeah, so for me, that really comes from Audre Lorde had this early author statement that I know you've seen that she used in multiple places, where she says, and I'm paraphrasing, but she says, you know, I wasn't born in a forest. I was born hemmed in by stone. But she talks about the fact that her poetic practice has to do with being able to find warmth and light in the cold places and to pass on to her children the knowledge of how do we actually have a relationship to light no matter where we are. And I started to think about that and I was like, okay, so that's Black feminist photosynthesis. She's talking about how do we process light. And in the biography, I end up looking at how Audre Lorde, and you know, this is another reason why I'm so grateful for your work. We can't understand Audre Lorde or any of our other writers as individuals. We understand them as part of a forest, right? A macro organism, an ecosystem that can't exist without each other. And so I wanted to understand Audre Lorde in that way, and to even understand the pieces of paper that, as someone who does archival research, that I was looking through to say, okay, well, this is a forest. You know, this is a forest in another form. But also, when you hear people talk about Audre Lorde's impact, right? When I talked to Pratibha Parmar about her impact on Black British feminists in the United Kingdom, she would use words like root structure. You know, this she is a part of our root structure. This is our ancestry. And I think that it's really important to understand that, especially because Audre Lorde was a theorist of light, right? We
You
have
know,
her.
when you say this, it makes me think about, and June Jordan appears in your biography in her relationship with Audre Lorde. But I'm looking at June Jordan's connection with Buckminster Fuller. And so you have this sort of very interesting thing, you know, geodesic domes, you know, you're talking about the earth. And it just seems that you can feel that there's a connection in terms of ideas between Audre Lorde, June Jordan, Buckminster Fuller, and yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a connection there because it's, I mean, this is the question, right? The question is our collective survival. And June Jordan was fascinated by this. I mean, she was talking to Buckminster Fuller. It's interesting because you know, the tapes have now been digitized at Harvard, so you can listen on their website, and I really recommend for folks to do that. But what you'll see is it's the same tapes, like the opposite side of the same tapes, or sometimes even taped over. You know how people reuse tapes. She's having these conversations with Buckminster Fuller, and she's having conversations with the survivors of the Jackson State Massacre in Mississippi, right? And then for me, I was like, oh, so she's learning from Fannie Lou Hamer. June Jordan's being mentored by Fannie Lou Hamer and learning about the Freedom Farm and the whole ecological system and theory that Fannie Lou Hamer was involved in Mississippi, at the same time that she's having these conversations with Buckminster Fuller, who's trying to think about how every child can be fed, right? It's not a separate conversation. And this is one of the things that had me realize, okay, wait a minute, you know, Alexis DeVoe and Gwendolyn Hardwick are having salon sessions about the nuclear impact, right? June Jordan's writing about what it means for toxic waste to be driven through Harlem.
Well, you know, the other writer that's mentioned should be included in there because she's at City College also. That's Toni Kaye Bambara.
Absolutely, absolutely. And Toni Kaye Bambara is the one who offers us the fact that existence is existing on every scale at once, right? So what's happening in me, in each cell of my body, and what's happening with the planet, the impact of nuclear waste,
So
you
you
know,
know the
that
next question I have
she.
to ask you, Alexis. You know the next question. The question is, do you want to be well?
Exactly, which is always the question. The other question is, what are you pretending not to know today, right? From education of a storyteller. Yeah, I do want to be well. I do want to be well. And, you know, when I think about what our Black feminist writers have offered us, it is actually a well. It is actually, you know, as I sit here with my water trying to hydrate this morning, it's a deep well of nourishment, but it's also the depth of it is part of our responsibility, right? And this is what Toni Kaye Bambara has Minnie Ransom say in The Salt Eaters. It's a commitment. It's a lot of work if you want to be well. And if we really want to engage the depth of what our thinkers were giving us, we have to go there. And that's part of my work with this biography of Audre Lorde, is to say, yes, we need everything Audre Lorde said about identity and about difference and about speaking our truth and being our whole selves. We need it. I need it. And I wouldn't exist without it. But also, Audre Lorde and all these other thinkers we've mentioned were actually talking about a complete shift in our relationship to the planet. And we have to go that deep if
Well,
we want to be well.
before we go to that deep, let's go back to you being 14 years old. Okay. Okay. So you were introduced to Audre Lorde's work around when you were about 14. I'm curious, what didn't you understand about her poetry when you first read it? And were there specific poems that opened a window or unlocked the door for you to better grasp what she was writing about?
You know, I mean, I think that there's so many layers, and this is what happens when you engage a great work, right? Every time you engage it, there's more there. And when I was 14, I was just first really drawn in by the beauty of Audre Lorde's poetry. I was like, these images, the way she's writing about light, the way
But let
that
me ask you
there's,
something there.
yeah.
Did you see, because this happens with when we talk about Jimmy Baldwin, you know, everybody says this. I was in the library and I walked past and I saw this face staring out at me. You know, was there a photograph of Audre Lorde that pulled you into this woman?
You know, it wasn't first a photograph, actually. You
It was
know,
the work itself.
it was the work itself. And now, having worked a lot with photographs of Audre Lorde, I know you've noticed this. She looks so different in every photograph.
Sort of like
You
Billie
know, yeah,
Holiday.
there's some shapeshifter energy happening. But yeah, it was the the beauty and the complexity of the work, I think that I first just resonated with as a 14-year-old. And then, of course, I've had the gift of learning more about Audre Lorde, of doing the archival research, of reading the works that other people have created. And
well, let's talk about you poet to poet.
Because
you're a poet. And I was just wondering, okay, are you trying to copy what Audre Lorde is writing? You know, is the form structure?
It's impossible. It's impossible. You know, never that, never that. However, I am trying to hold myself to the standard that I know she held herself to and that she held her students to, which is to say that poetry, if it's poetry, you know, like if it's working, it's impacting us on every level, right? So my rigor with myself in my poetic process is, yes, the energy has to come through. You know, there has to be, you know, James Brown would say every instrument is a drum. Mm-hmm. A poem is a drum. Like at a certain point, there has to be, I would like that our poetry
this
in
sounds
any-
like Jane, this sounds like Jane Cortez. With the
yeah,
drum.
That's right. That's right. And I'm so influenced also by Jane Cortez. The rhythm of it, the rhythm of it has to do something. There's a vibration that has to come through. And if there's anything that's blocking that, I have to get out of the way of it. And so I could never say that I could copy Audre Lorde or, you know, be the poet Audre Lorde was, but I can hold myself to this type of standard that she held herself to. And, you know, I'm realizing more and more that part of the rigor of Audre Lorde's poetry is that we often think about, well, poetry, it's metaphorical. It's, you know, it's in some ways like seven layers removed from existence, and it's not, you know, it's embodied. And when we write about earth, when Audre Lorde wrote about stones, when I write about whales, it's not a metaphor. It's a relationship. And that shifts everything. It shifts our accountability. It shifts what the relationship to the reader is, because the reader is not just like noticing some beautiful wordplay that we're doing. The reader is implicated in their relationship, and they get to think about their relationship to earth, to other people, to themselves.
In 1978, Audre Lorde gives us The Black Unicorn. Mm-hmm. What's special about this book?
You know, it's really my favorite. It's really my favorite. And not to say I refuse to give up any part of Audre Lorde's body of work, but The Black Unicorn was special to Audre too. You know, it was a work that she held sacred, and she didn't really excerpt it for her collected poems, partially because of that. And it's important because Audre Lorde describes it as one conversation with an ancestral Audre. And we get so much out of it. I mean, she's talking about Assata Shakur. She's talking about contemporary things that were happening on the news and in our communities while she was writing it. But she's also engaged in this deep research and resonance with West African mythologies and cosmologies, religious systems and figures. And she's understanding that there is a connection of what it means for her to be a Black feminist in the United States that also has everything to do with...
Let's hold that point, because I'm listening to you. So we see Audre Lorde doing that. And then I'm thinking of someone like Nathaniel Mackie.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that there's this other way of looking at things, you know, this connection, ancestral Africa. You know, you see a connection between them? Because we're going from women to men.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a connection between Audre Lorde and Nathaniel Mackie's work. I think that The Black Unicorn is the place where we see most that you can listen to yourself, right? I mean, it's like this embodiment of Sankofa where there's this multiplicity. So you can see in, you know, Bedouin Hornbook, you can see in Nathaniel Mackie's work that there's a conversation that's happening, and it's a conversation that's multidimensional. And I think that is what Audre Lorde does in The Black Unicorn. She said, okay, there's Audre, this, you know, this figure who was born and will die, but then there's also this other energy that's right. Older and that's coming through and that's not limited to an individual lifetime. And that's the place that she's writing from in that work. And I think it's so profound. I think, I don't know, I mean, make promises on the radio, but I feel like I want to just do weekly sessions where we go poem by poem with the poems in the Black Unicorn, because every time I read any one of those poems, I have these questions that come up for me for my own
Well,
life. And
this is my next question to you when she said that, because you write in Survival is a Promise that one has to make a lifetime commitment to reading and teaching Audre Lorde. That's what you say in the book. I was just wondering in these times, how do we teach Audre Lorde and how do we teach her many selves?
Listen, that's why it takes lifetimes. There's so much, there's so many selves. There's the selves that she allows to come through in her work, and then there's the possible selves within us that we get access to through her work. So it's really infinite, which is why I'm like, let's all do this. It can't be one person. It has to be all of us. I think that there's no I mean, I think, and one of my mentors, Fred Moten, models this in a really beautiful way. He will teach a whole seminar, just on one work by Hortense Spillers, which is correct, right? We need that. There's so many places to go. There's such a complexity. There's such a richness. And I think that this is a beautiful thing, is that we have the opportunity to dwell with these thinkers and not rush through to try to just consume it all and, then just become experts trying to spit it back, but like to dwell. I think that the Black Unicorn, I mean, I've been studying it for decades and I'll never stop.
Has there been any attempt to, this speaks to our times, has there been any attempts to censor Audre Lorde, pull her books from off the library shelves?
Yeah. I mean, this is part of what's been going on in Florida with Audre Lorde and many of our figures. There's been a push in schools and in libraries to erase her. And it's exactly because of how powerful and empowering her work is, how it's changed so many people's lives. I mean, as a 14-year-old, what if I had never had access to Audre Lorde? What kind of life would I be living? What kind of frame of possibility would I have? It would be much more limited. I would be a much more easy person to control if I never had Audre Lorde in my life. The irony, of course, is that Audre Lorde herself was a librarian, and she was a person who was bringing materials into the library that were not part of the library, the director of the library's curation, because she wanted to be accountable to the young people, the young Black people in her community who the library wasn't even trying to be welcoming to, but she was like, you need to be here and you need to be able to read the things that are going to empower
You know,
you.
you open a whole door of somebody could do a study of African American writers who are librarians. I'm thinking like Dudley Randall, and I think maybe Anna Bond Thompson, but these people are like in the library, and being very helpful to others. Alexis, we're going to take a little break, and I'll have so much to talk to you about. But my guest this morning is Alexis Pauline Gums. She's the author of Survival is a Promise, The Internal Life of Audre Lorde. My name is Ethelbert Miller. The show's Maiden Voice. The station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Mumia Abu-Jamal reminds us that August is a month of repression, of radical resistance, of injustice and divine justice, of righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slaves and break the chains that bind us. On August 29th, from 1 until 7 p.m., through both public affairs and music, WPFW reflects on the origins of Black August and honors the lives and legacies of Jonathan and George Jackson and all Black freedom fighters as we recommit to the sovereignty and resilience of Black people around the world. That's Black August, Thursday, August 29th, 1 until 7 p.m. on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time. Black August,
not February. Okay, we're back on the margin with my guest, Alexis Pauline Gums. Alexis, we are celebrating the 100th birthday of James Baldwin. When I think of Baldwin, I immediately think of his essays, The Price of the Ticket. When I think of Audre Lorde, I think of Sister Outsider. What are the important essays of Audre Lorde, and are there things in her essays that are not in her poems?
Oh, what a great question. James Baldwin's essays, have had such an impact on me. And in fact, of all his work, his essays that stay with me the most. With Audre Lorde, it really is the poetry that stays with me the most, but her essays, and you know, she was reluctant, you know, Nancy Barriano, who was her publisher for Sister Outsider, she talks about Audre being like, nobody's gonna wanna read essays by me, you know, I'm a poet. And of course she was wrong, right? I mean, in fact, so much so that the essays, some people don't even read the poetry because they just stay with the essays. I don't think that there's anything in the essays that's not in the poetry, because they really are coming from the same questions within Audre Lorde, but it's such a different method, right? And we see this too with Sylvia Winter. You know, most of the Audre Lorde's published essays, not all, but most of them were speeches. They were academic conference papers. You know, they were presentations that she gave to a specific audience out loud. And there's something about the accountability, urgency, and community of that that's really important. Now, that said, I feel like if people only read one essay by Audre Lorde, the essay I would want them to read is her essay, Eye to Eye, Black Women, Hatred, and Anger. That is my favorite one of her essays. That's the one that it confounds me. I keep going back to it because it really is about how internalized oppression works and how we use what oppression has taught us against each other in community. And this is one of the most important things that we got to reckon with, you know, if we're going to be able to collaborate in the ways that we need to collaborate. It's also a beautiful essay and it's impacted so many people. You know, it impacted Joseph Beam, and he was very much modeled by that when he wrote Brother to Brother, his essay that appears in his book In the Life. And yeah, I would say that if people stay with the essays though and don't go to the poetry, you really are missing, you're missing what Audre Lorde believed was the center of her life, you know? And Elizabeth Lord Rollins, Audre Lorde's daughter, has said that, you know, Audre Lorde was a poet because she had to be. She was an essayist because there were certain things that, you know, had to be said in a certain way at a certain time. But she was a poet in her soul. You know, like even if she had lived in a time where there was no racism and there was no homophobia and there was somehow no need for feminism and all of these things, she still would have been a poet. And that's really for her the core. And so we miss Audre Lorde if we don't engage her poetry. And, you know, I feel like you've been encouraging people around this for a long time. We miss out on life, right? If we don't engage the poets. I think sometimes people are intimidated and they're like, I don't want to get it wrong, or, you know, maybe I'm misinterpreting, and we just got to get over it. Of course, maybe we're wrong. You know, like just like in every conversation with any person or any day that we live, we're not going to get it right. We're here to be transformed by the experience and to experience it as deeply as we can. And for Audre Lorde and for so many of our poets, poetry is a technology of that deepening of experience.
Talk about Audre Lorde and her search for the erotic, and does it help her overcome her disabilities?
Yeah, so one of the things that was important for me to really bring readers into in this biography is Audre Lorde's childhood and the ableism that she faced as a child who was severely, severely nearsighted and who didn't speak until the age of 4 or 5, and who experienced medical harm because of that, but also who had to find ways to connect that were nonverbal and that, you know, had to bring people close. If you can't see the expression on someone's face as a child, now, you know, developmental psychologists have theorized and written about this, it's really hard to socialize or to understand what's going on around you if you both can't say anything and also can't be, you know, reading this kind of communication of facial expressions either. And so Audre Lorde, I understand, and of course this is me trying to imagine her childhood when I wasn't there and when she wasn't writing yet, she could only connect with what she could touch, you know, like what really is at hand's distance, what she could hold in her hands, and would have to bring people close in order to be able to understand them or be understood, which is interesting to me because we do see when she is writing or when other people are writing about her that she did bring people close, you know, and she talked about her nearsightedness, like she got to bring things like 3 centimeters from her eye to really see them. And she felt like she was doing that in her life. She was trying to bring people really close. And there is an eroticism to that, right? There is an intimacy to that. And so when we see, you know, all the pictures that I've looked through of Audre Lorde, where, you know, she has her hand on somebody's shoulder, she has her hand on their wrist, she's really looking them closely in the face. Like these are things that I see as a testament to the fact that there's a closeness that was required, especially in a time where she couldn't depend on seeing anything from far away or calling out and reaching for something, even asking for help.
When you say that, it made me think of somebody. I always enjoyed looking at Robert Hayden reading poems because his glasses were very thick. So I felt you've got to get up. You got to get your nose up into that.
That's right.
But it was a thing where, you know, and I want to jump ahead in terms of when I'm thinking about this body, you know, that she's dealing, Audre Lorde's dealing with. Then I'm looking later on in life when we get the cancer journals. Mm-hmm. How is she wrestling with her body changing?
Yeah. And, you know, and this is one of the reasons why Audre Lorde has been such an important figure for disability justice. The intersectionality that she offers, but also the way that, you know, unlike many people, she wasn't hiding major illnesses, right? Major challenges, embodied challenges that she was having. She actually understood it as just as important for her to be out about her medical experience as it was for her to be out about her sexuality, for example, and about her politics. So when we get this, she embraces change, you know, and when she has to have a mastectomy in part of her journey with cancer, she's drawing a line, and this is again the work of the Black Unicorn that she did, she's drawing a line to Amazon warriors. She's drawing a line to warriors who would cut off a breast because they were archers and that was what they needed to do in order to play their warrior role. She really researched and looked at African indigenous traditions of body modification that grounded her in the fact that she embraced the changes of her body, right? She refused to wear a prosthesis. She started to create her own jewelry to accentuate the fact that now she's an asymmetrical person, right? With one breast. And I think that that's a really important example and model, but it's also a part of how we see Audre Lorde's theory of Earth, that Earth is not stable. Our bodies are not stable. All of it is in transformation. And when we pretend that it's not, when we live in denial around that, that's when we get unsustainable systems. That's when we get out of balance. And yeah, I think that if she was not able to reckon with transformation in her body, I don't think she would have been able to listen to her body in the way that allowed her to, you know, completely change her eating patterns, to really look at the impact of pesticides, to take an immune approach to living with cancer that gave her a quality of life and a longevity that the American medical system thought was impossible at the time. So I think that there's a lot that's possible when we embrace change.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about something I think is also, it's very important. You mentioned this in your biography. Talk about the importance of her being West Indian, because I know this was something that was also very important to June Jordan. These women are West Indian women.
Mm-hmm. It's very important, you know.
Wrestling with their West Indian fathers.
Exactly, exactly.
like Kamala Harris.
Right, right. And as a person with my own West Indian father, I get it. You know, when June Jordan writes in her tribute to Audre Lorde on Audre Lorde's first birthday after she passed away, she talks about, this is part of what it means to be West Indian, you know, thousands of pages of thousands of books, right? And so literacy was a huge thing for Audre Lorde's father, for June Jordan's father, and something that they really encouraged. And And I do think it also, you can see it in the way that both poets have a global perspective, right? They are interested in the United States' political economic impact over the world, because, you know, that impact in the Caribbean is crucial and is actually horrifying and recolonizing. And also that is a place that they both use to connect to other women, especially other Black and Indigenous women around the world. This sense of another possibility, you know, this sense that you may be growing up in a Black space, right, in Harlem, New York, but inside of, like, that's policed by white people, right? And that is a zone of colonial extraction for white people. But you are raised by people who come from a majority Black place that's exploited in different ways, right? But that gives this kind of breadth of experience. And Audre Lorde really held on to this idea that her mother was like, well, yeah, we do live here, but home is a different thing. Home is a deeper thing and a richer thing. And for Audre Lorde, that began to mean not just, you know, well, we should go back, even though she did end up living in St. Croix at the end of her life, and it was important for her to live in the Caribbean for the last years of her life. But this sense of home being something more expansive is actually becomes the creative potentiality of her writing. Like that, okay, there's our life that we're having here, and there's always something more. And that something more is something that we're creating and remembering at the same time.
You know, when you're talking about this international aspect, and we go from the West Indies to Europe, Audre Lorde has a significant impact on Afro-Germans.
Yes.
I think that she made about around 1980, I think she made about 9 trips to Berlin. But mm-hmm. but talk about, you know, she's going over there for treatment, but she's also teaching, and she mm-hmm. seems as if there's, she's interacting with Afro-Germans who really need to get a sense of a model. How do we navigate, you know, this country as Black women?
That's right. That's right. So Audre Lorde, in 1984, teaches her first class at the Free University in Berlin. And at first, it's all white students in there, right? And she's adamant, like, where are the Afro-Germans? I know that there's Afro-Germans, right? This is something that she's known about, but she's like, this is why I'm here. And so you have figures like Katarina Oguntoye and Mai Ayim, who find her classes. And, you know, these are scholars who are being told in German universities they want to write about Black people, they want to write about racism in Germany, mm-hmm. and their professors are like, what do you mean? There's no such thing as racism in Germany, right? So for them to find Audre Lorde, who was like, yes, and also experiencing the profound levels of rejection that these Afro-German feminists write about, of being rejected within their families, of their Blackness being something that's supposed to, like, at best, be ignored, for Audre Lorde to be like, oh no, this is what's beautiful about you, you know, and everyone should know this, and you should write your story so that women all over the world can learn from you. This is like a complete 180 for them in terms of the affirmation that they needed, right? So these people who we see rightly as founding figures of Afro-German feminist movement, but also Afro-German movement, period, they really, many of them found each other going to Audre Lorde's class or to her different events and her different readings. And she was so interested in them. You know, she was so excited to mentor them. And that was definitely a contribution to what they were able to create together.
Let's talk about some of the things that, going back, were very controversial, you know, mm-hmm. even the term like feminist. But I was wondering about the relationship between white lesbians and Black lesbians, mm-hmm. and where Audre Lorde fits into that. And then also in terms of people wrestling with issues in terms of white and Black, but having, you know, perhaps their lover might be white.
Yeah. I mean, this is a major complexity. And for Audre Lorde, I mean, at different moments of her life, I think she's relating to this differently. But yeah, there's a lot to be said. I think one piece of it is that You know, Audre Lorde was in a partnership with Francis Clayton, the brilliant psychologist Francis Clayton, for 17 years. Mm-hmm. And she did not separate the work that it was to be in that relationship and the processing and the, you know, all of the negotiation of what it was to be in an interracial lesbian relationship with her question of what was possible in terms of Black feminists and white feminists being able to create an anti-racist reality. And so this was really important to her. And I think that in terms of her anti-racist work, she saw this as a part of it, you know, not a contradiction, like, well, I'm pro-Black, but here I'm with this white woman, which is a contradiction many people have faced, you know, in their lives. But in her case, it was like, I'm a Black feminist. I'm about the liberation of Black people. And there has to be some kind of coalition with anti-racist white people in order for this to happen in a powerful way. And this is part of what I'm working out. Now, I do think that there are things that were possible when she moved into her relationship with Gloria Joseph, another Black feminist, at the end of her life, that also offered this depth where she, at that point, was prioritizing her relationship.
But it seemed almost like a homecoming.
Yes, I think it very much was a homecoming, you know, and it ends up facilitating her move to live in the Caribbean again. It also is the foundation of her solidarity with Black women, right? So it's Gloria Joseph who goes with Audre Lorde to Grenada, right, after the U.S. invasion of Grenada, to really witness and to be in solidarity with what has happened there. None of it is separate, right? So I think that there's also a lot of pain, you know, that Audre Lorde experienced in terms of racism from white lesbian feminists. Mm-hmm. And so when she met Barbara Smith, you know, when she met Demita Frazier, when she met this like half step younger generation of Black lesbian feminists who created the Combahee River Collective, that was another homecoming for her, because she had so often been tokenized. You know, she's so often been like, I'm the only Black woman here, you know, in so many spaces. And that was not safe, you know, and she experienced a lot of toxicity in that. And so there was a strengthening that was part of Audre Lorde's relationships with Black women. But there was also an important part of her political analysis that had to do with her relationships, romantic, but also, you know, deep friendships and chosen family relationships with white lesbian feminists, including Adrienne Rich, including, you know, Claire Koss, Blanche Wieson Cook, people who were very important to her, Frances Clayton, of course. So I think there's all that complexity there. None of it goes away, you know, none of the reality of racism and none of the longing, you know, for homecoming ever goes away.
You know, you're right that Audre Lorde wanted people to study her life, to learn from her mistakes. What mistakes did Audre Lorde make?
You know, the same mistakes that we all make, right? I would say that Audre Lorde, you know, she could be hard on herself in her journal. She would review her days, you know, she'd be like, oh, why did I say this? You know, why didn't I say this? You know, I think that some things that she saw as mistakes were that she, and this is why she studied her anger, you know, and this is why Black women, hatred and anger is such an important, the eye to eye essay is so important, because she would think about, I'm doing all this work to try to like channel peace and, you know, I'm working all day at CUNY or, you know, whatever it is that she's doing. And then she lashes out. She finds herself lashing out at the people in her own family or the people in her life. And she's like, oh, it's that power dynamic again, right? Where it's safer to lash out at the people who really love you, but that's not in alignment with her vision or her politics or her ethics, right? So I think she wanted us to look at how do we also do that? And, you know, how do we let fear and pride get in our way? You know, I think that there are, lost relationships. I think that there are lost opportunities for collaboration that she saw in her life. And she wanted to document those things, you know, and she wanted us to be able to be stronger around that. She was processing those things in her poetry, right? Sometimes she thought it was a mistake that she taught composition at John Jay College for Criminal Justice because she wondered if she was making it easier for people who were part of the injustice system to justify what they were doing, which included murdering Black children, right? So so she was a very self-critical person. And I think that she wanted us to have that rigor. And when she talked with Audre, when Audre Lorde talked with Gloria Joseph about, you know, her legacy and wanting it to continue, she said that, she emphasized that, you know, like that people have a lot to learn from my mistakes because other people are out here making mistakes, right? You know, like it's relatable and we need that as much as we need to honor, you know, the depth of gratitude we have and the bravery and the innovation that Audre Lorde and, you know, all of our other important literary figures have given us. We also need to know that the work that they created came through the crucible of what we all must do, which is to look at ourselves rigorously and to understand that we can actually move more into alignment with our values.
Well, I must confess, I've been talking to you, Alexis Pauline Combs, all morning, and I made a mistake. I'm talking to you, and I'm sitting on this.
On Alma Thomas. Yes.
My Alma Thomas pillow.
I need one of those.
I'm not sending you this one. But what's coming. You have a book of poems that's inspired by Alma Thomas's work. And I'm wondering, make this connection as we come to the end of our show. Move us quickly from Audre Lorde to Alma Thomas.
Yeah. Okay. So Alma Thomas. Okay. Especially for a DC audience, you know, Alma Thomas is so important. For folks who may not know, the great painter Alma Thomas, who was born in 1891 in Columbus, Georgia, and who went on to be one of the most important abstract painters, color theorists ever. And she taught at Shaw Junior High School in DC Public Schools for 30 years. She influenced generations of artists in multiple ways. And I could go on, which is why I had to write about her every day. This is the type of artist who you got to stay with, you know? And so that's what I had to do. I went to the retrospective exhibit, Everything is Beautiful. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to just be able to like write one poem about this. You know, I'm going to actually have to write every single day. And that's what I did. You know, I sat with like painting after painting after painting, and I just allowed myself to go where it took me. But one of the things that's important, so this collection is tentatively, unless the title changes, it's called Primary. And it really works with what was Alma Thomas's real primary audience? You know, because as an abstract painter, as somebody who painted non-figurative, brightly colored paintings, there's a way that people are like, oh, you know, she's transcending racism. Oh, it's much easier to look at these paintings than to look at the paintings of someone who's depicting racism, to look at Faith Ringgold's work that's, you know, like explicitly talking about.
But I looked at how we were talking all day, all morning about Audre Lorde and the earth. Mm-hmm. And I know that there are paintings in which Alma Thomas is influenced by the space program.
Absolutely. She understood herself as a painter of earth, right? So she starts painting these round flower beds from her grandparents' house where she grew up in Georgia. And then in DC, she starts painting, you know, the land, the flowers. But then when she's able to see pictures and images from the space shuttles, she's like, oh, earth, right? And the whole time her paintings of earth, she described them as like from above, like flying past them. Now remember, this is somebody born in 1891, right? But she's having this vision of like a bird's eye view. And part of what I think there's, you know, and this is all speculative, even though I have done a lot of digging into Alma Thomas's archives, which are available because of the Smithsonian. She is thinking about the planet. She's thinking on a planetary scale. She's thinking about light. So she and Audre Lorde are both theorists of light. And I think they are both working through a particular form of accountability and grief. So I'm going to try to say this quickly. Mm-hmm. When I think about primary, one way we can think about the primary audience for Alma Thomas's work, of course, is her students, right? She was the first person to create art galleries inside the DC public schools. She was committed to children. But I also think about She's the oldest sister. I'm the oldest sister. Yesterday was National Eldest Sisters Day, I found out. And one of her younger sisters died from diphtheria as a young girl. And sometimes I think about what if her sister, Fanny, was the actual primary audience for her work. And so my poems imagine kind of that relationship, how that could change the way we think about who the primary audience is for abstract art. And Audre Lorde was doing this, you know, in Zami, she was thinking about her childhood best friend who died by suicide. She was thinking about her childhood classmate, Alvin, who died from tuberculosis. And she was in her work, she always had these like ghost audiences that were
But
important to
we
her
don't have a
too.
ghost audience today.
We have a real audience. We have a, but we have, but we have a ghost audience too, you know?
Well, Alexis, I want to thank you, Alexis Bowling Gumps. I want to
Thank
thank you
you.
because I felt when I heard you. Okay, we gotta go. We gotta go. So,
Okay,
Alexis Bowling Gumps, you're my special guest.
thank
Just I'm E. Ethelbert Miller. The show's Maiden Voice, and I mean Maiden Voice on the margin. That's my
you.
old
On the
show. On
margin.
the margin. Okay, and the station is WPFW 89.3 FM.
Mumia Abu-Jamal reminds us that August is a month of repression, of radical resistance, of injustice and divine justice, of righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slaves and break the chains that bind us. On August 29th, from 1 until 7 p.m., through both public affairs and music, WPFW reflects on the origins of Black August and honors the lives and legacies of Jonathan and George Jackson and all Black freedom fighters as we recommit to the sovereignty and resilience of Black people around the world. That's Black August, Thursday, August 29th, 1 until 7 p.m. on WPFW, Building a Better World, one broadcast at a time.
Black August, not February, for every weary soul who had to bury those in the cemetery.
School is back. Do you need an after-school program for your young one? The Words, Beats, and Life Academy is enrolling for students from third grade up to young adults with programming weekdays, 3:30 to 6 p.m., offering classes in hip-hop performing and visual arts, as well as business and arts leadership, with access to professional teaching artists, equipment, and resources. Located in Columbia Heights, Northwest Washington, D.C. at St. Stephen's Church. Classes are always free. Enrollment at wblinc.org/academy, based on availability. The fall session begins September 9th. We hope to see you or your young one there at the Words, Beats, and Life After School Academy.
All right, all right.
Remember, wblinc.org/academy.
Hey, it's that time again. Join WPFW as we move to get fit at the annual 5K run walk for total fitness. Dynamic fitness instructors will be there, free healthy snacks and water, exciting music, boat rides for families, and a double dutch contest and a hand dance contest are all included in the 5K fundraiser. This event takes place at the Bladensburg Waterfront Park, 4601 Annapolis Road in Bladensburg, Maryland, from 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. on Saturday, September 14th. Now, for more details on how to register, visit our website, wpfw.org, or call 202-888-5484. That's 202-888-5484. Meet you at the park on Saturday, September 14th, 1 p.m. to 7 p.m. WPFW, making a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Education, art, health, music, politics, and all things community.
Yes!
Join me, Ambrose Lane Jr., as we uncover the issues of DC communities east of the river on To the East, Mondays at 5 p.m. right here on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW 89.3 FM.
Hey, Chris Garlock here.
And I'm Elise Bryant.
Every week, we explore labor arts and culture
on the Labor Heritage Hour Hour.
Thursdays from 1 to 2 p.m.